From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. This week, Congress wrapping for recess, a confession from the CIA, Ebola spreading, and a ceasefire that has not held in Gaza. All week, rockets, missiles, and a rising death count as Israeli forces go after Hamas and hit many, not just fighters. A last-minute push does not clear the docket in Congress. Here's Democratic Representative Debbie Wasserman Schultz of Florida.
This is the do-nothingest of do-nothing Congresses.
And a deadly Ebola virus outbreak has now killed more than 700 and continues to spread across West Africa. Dr. Steve Monroe with the CDC.
This is the most serious outbreak of Ebola virus that we've ever faced. It's essentially a multi-front war against the virus.
This hour on Point, our weekly news roundtable with Brian Monroe of CNN, Ron Mott of NBC, and Ann Simmons of the Los Angeles Times. You can join us on air or online where this conversation is always on. What do you see this week in Gaza, Congress, the CIA, the U.S. economy? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me now in the studio is Brian Monroe, editor for opinion at CNN.com. Brian, welcome back to On Point. Great to see you.
Always good to be here.
Ron Mott joins us here as well, correspondent for NBC News. Ron Mott, welcome.
Hey, Tom. Thank you.
And Ann Simmons of the Los Angeles Times is here, former Johannesburg bureau chief for the LA Times. She's reported from Russia and Iraq, now wields a video camera for her paper, New World. Ann Simmons, welcome to you.
Thanks so much for having me, Tom.
Jack Beatty is off today, and all three of my guests are in Boston for a big meeting of the National Association of Black Journalists. Our good luck. It's great to have you all here. Let's dive in. Congress, a lot of things that did not happen before they wrapped up. Above all, the immigration thing, the border crisis, all these unaccompanied minors. Brian, here we've got them still on the border. John Boehner hanging on to his House members today, deeper into the day, trying to get something done, but it's not going to be a full answer. What happened here?
It won't even be close. The president's original proposal, $5 billion plus, to help provide relief on the border for judges, for securing some of the border crossings, but also to take care of a lot of those kids who are coming in. That was a non-starter for them. They tried to ramp it back to $3.7 billion, mm-hmm. $2.7 billion. Now,
and we're only down into $600,000 at some point.
Exactly. They'll be able to buy some chewing gum and some other things. But that may not even pass because there are so many members of Boehner's own caucus who think it's not conservative enough. And that's what is going to stop them. And they may not get out of town. They may get out of town with no deal at all.
I mean, you've got Republicans saying we've got to do something. Here's Republican Congressman Blake Fahrenthold of Texas saying he's got migrant children in his district among these unaccompanied minors. Something needs to be done.
This is such an important problem. I mean, you've got children whose lives are in danger making this trip. You've got cramped, crowded conditions, even on our side of the border.
Ann Simmons, here's the president of the United States just a few days ago now, down talking with leaders of countries in Central America from where these are coming. But they're still coming, and the United States hasn't worked out a change in policy or the funding this week to take care of the problem at the border or beyond.
It's just a humanitarian catastrophe, and what an irony for the U.S. to have kind of refugees, if you wish, coming in across the border. Something obviously has to be done. It should have been done before now, and we've got, again, this crisis brewing. We've got kids coming over. They need to be taken care of. There's no really good end in sight here.
Ron Mott, this was the year early on that people said, we'll get something done on immigration. Republicans can't afford not to act here because we've got more votes coming up and it matters at the ballot box. And yet, John Boehner not happy about this, but as this day began, still not able to move on this front, a kind of paralysis. Is this issue of the unaccompanied minors at the border become a proxy for the big immigration question?
I mean, I think so. And I don't want to be the cynic on the panel, but I begin to wonder whether the folks in Washington even know how to legislate anymore. I'm not even sure they know the process to go about getting an agreement together that everyone can be happy with. Clearly, there's a crisis on the border, but they're about to go off on their summer recess. We've got a handful, a dozen or so legislative dates remaining for the rest of the year. That's not a lot of time to try to con- try to come up with a package that makes sense, that works for everybody in 12 or 13 sessions. So we'll have to see how they do it.
5 weeks away and a lot undone. Even things that did get done, there was a lot of concern about this. Infrastructure, highway trust fund that was running out of money. Projects threatened to shut straight down. They came up with money, but they did it in part by what a lot of critics are calling a gimmick, Republicans included. That is, to cover the cost of fixing up highways and bridges, they're letting American companies defer required contributions to their employee pension plans, then chalk up more profit because of that, tax them on the profit. But then, of course, there's that deficit, that pothole in the pension plan. Here's Tennessee Republican Senator Bob Corker talking about that kind of what he calls kicking the can down the road, quote unquote, fix.
I can't support another kicking the can down the road on one of the simplest issues we have to deal with in the United States Senate because elections are coming up.
Do we get out of this in the post-midterm election somehow, Brian? Does the Congress find, Eric Cantor says, I'm leaving early, so I hope my Republican successor will come in and vote on these things. Is there relief in sight when we don't have elections right in front of us after the midterms?
No.
Okay.
It's so fascinating being in D.C. and watching how Congress works. You know, some good legislators there who either don't have the desire or the ability to legislate. You saw with this transportation bill, they even screwed up by $2 billion because they didn't have the language proper for between the House and the Senate bill. So they have to go back together. And now the House is saying, oh, we may not pick this up. And I mean, the basics, they're not even getting the basics right. But the larger issue, and it's fascinating to watch over the tenure of President Obama, mm-hmm. is that the Republican-controlled House does not seem to want to do and pass anything that gives the president any kind of long-term legacy. So you see these continuing resolutions, you see these short-term bills, you see these kicking the can down the road propositions because they don't want to have anything left that can stick. And so they want to come back and fix it and change it and update it and revise it throughout these next two or three years. So I don't think anything's going to happen.
Confrontation, kind of the name of the game on that front. One thing that did pass this week was in the House, approval to move forward with a lawsuit against the president for overreaching on his executive authority. Here was Speaker John Boehner on Wednesday asking House members to support this move.
Are you willing to let any president choose what laws to execute and what laws to change? Are you willing to let anyone tear apart what our founders have built?
You get the tone of that. And, of course, a lot of Republicans very upset about what they do see as the president going too far and kind of nipping and tucking once legislation's already done. A lot of that was done with Obamacare. The president in Kansas City on Wednesday talked about that, the threat of a suit from the House.
They're mad because I'm doing my job. And by the way, I've told them, I said, I'd be happy to do it with you. So the only reason I'm doing it on my own is because you don't do anything.
Ron Mott, clearly a friendly crowd put together there for the president in Kansas City.
In my hometown.
Your hometown, you can hear it. But what about the Republican complaint that, you know, the president may not like where he's ended up with laws sometimes, but he's been too aggressive in coming in and using executive authority to kind of bend them once they've already been passed. They want to push back on that in the courts. How do you see that, Ron?
I don't think anyone knows what's going to happen with this resolution now that it's passed and whether this is actually going to end up in a courtroom or whether a judge will even take it. But I think it works. This is mileage for the Republicans. This works for their base, and we've got an election in 91 days or whatever it is. They want their voters to come out, and they're in a pretty good position with 90 days to go. And I think the longer they can keep the media talking about this resolution and not so much talking about the I word, that's good for Republicans. The president is trying to respond to his base as well, saying that I've been left with no choice but to do these executive orders to get things done for the American people. We're going to see this battle go back and forth between now and November, but I think it's going to be one of those things where no one really knows where this will go from here. It's good politically for the Republicans.
Mm-hmm. To see it in the courts, that is going to be something to watch. If, in fact, they actually go ahead and make that step, the legislation this week just to give permission or say, yes, we can. And then the image this week of the CIA admitting that it had essentially spied on the Senate Intelligence Committee back in March. Here was Dianne Feinstein raising this accusation, which was initially vigorously denied by the CIA. Here's the California senator, head of that committee, in March.
I have grave concerns that the CIA's search may well have violated the separation of powers principles embodied in the United States Constitution, including the speech and debate clause. It may have undermined the constitutional framework essential to effective congressional oversight of intelligence activities or any other government function.
The response of the CIA in March, here's Director John Brennan, absolutely denying that this happened, talking here with NBC News' Andrea Mitchell.
Nothing could be further from the truth. I mean, we wouldn't do that. I mean, that's just beyond the scope of reason in terms of what we would do.
Beyond the scope of reason, but Ann Simmons, it appears they did. They are now conceding that they did get into the computers that the Senate Intelligence Committee was using to examine the record of torture, harsh interrogation under the CIA. It happened. They admit it.
Right. And it's really now, it really does show that there has been this breach of trust, basically. And it also shows that, my goodness, if the CIA is spying on the Senate Intelligence Committee, then who am I as an average American? You know, are they possibly spying on me? It raises all of these issues. It's definitely a red flag.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're looking at a week in the news. Gaza, a CIA confession, no deal on the U.S. border crisis, Ebola, Russia, U.S. tensions, and more with Ann Simmons of the Los Angeles Times, Brian Monroe of CNN, Ron Mott of NBC News, all with me here in the studio in Boston today. Jack Beatty's off. They're all in town for the National Association of Black Journalists Convention here, and we are very lucky and happy to have them. Let's get a call from Cortland, Ohio. Garland is calling. Hi, Garland. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Some of it reminds me of being at a museum, standing in front of a giant painting, some of those real large paintings where you can't get back far enough to see the whole painting. I feel like I'm standing in front of one of those paintings, and the country is right now. We're focusing on the thing we can see, the nearest. I know that's been a little...
You're talking about in Congress or the whole darn world?
No, the challenge is in front of the country. We keep putting them off till the next Congress or my successor in Congress. I think there was only Tom Coburn, I guess, is the kind. I'm a Democrat, but Tom Coburn's the one politician I respect the most. He really tried to be bipartisan and get things accomplished. I'm not calling on his behalf. But what I was calling about in the days when he was called controller, the U.S. Inspector General issued a report about 5 years ago comparing the things that were happening in this country to Rome and predicting a similar outcome. And it got very little media coverage, but it's coming to be. Unfortunately, it'll take time. But these guys and women can't keep putting off what has to be accomplished.
Garland, we don't have to accept that Rome path. Let's hope we can do better. I appreciate your call from Ohio. Brian, after the midterms, let's say... last week, we saw polls saying 60% chance the Republicans will take the Senate. In that case, we'll have a Republican Congress. Does that clear the underbrush here? Does that get us on a path to action, even if it's not what Democrats might like? Or does it just go straight up against a veto?
You will likely, if that indeed happens, you will like to see a president who will exercise his power to veto aggressively. He has made it clear that going down the more conservative path is not where he wants to take the country. And so with a Republican-controlled House and Republican-controlled Senate, which will generally, you can probably see that one of the first bills they will put out will be a repeal of Obamacare.
Mm-hmm.
That's not going to happen.
No, that's not going to get the president's signature. Ron Mott, we see you on NBC reporting from all over the country. I mean, you turn on the TV and you never know where you're going to be. So you talk with a lot of people in many parts of the country. Do you see more people or hear more people saying, we've got to break this logjam and act, or I'm not going to go left or I'm not going to go right. Let's stay in our trenches.
I think folks are staying in the trenches. And I think the only thing that will perhaps bring them out is to see even more dysfunction in Washington. And we may very well get that in January if the Republicans take control of the Senate. I think the fireworks will get more explosive if that happens. And I think the frustration in middle America will grow. And people will at some point decide we can't continue to live this way.
Ann Simmons, you've spent a lot of time reporting from overseas. The rest of the world, they look at the U.S. and see a big player who can act, or do they see us paralyzed at home, therefore less effective abroad?
I think there's a lot of disappointment overseas because in the past, other countries have looked to the U.S. as an example, as an example of a government that works and functions properly. And if the U.S. can't do it, a lot of countries think, well, my goodness, they're the leaders. How can we do it? So I think there is a lot of kind of disappointment and people who have looked at the U.S. as a role model in other places today have changed their minds.
We'll talk about this. But of course, these days you've got plenty of others, Russia foremost right now, saying, hey, you don't go down that American path. It doesn't work. Let's look at how that and more is playing out in the Middle East right now. Violence going on there this week, big time. The death toll now over 1,400 for Palestinians, 60-plus for Israelis, 3 civilians among those, many civilians among the Palestinian dead. Some shocking scenes this week where missiles have come down on schools again, on public marketplaces. Here was UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon. This was at the UN Security Council on Monday, demanding an end to the violence in Gaza.
It is time for an immediate, unconditional humanitarian ceasefire. In the name of humanity, the violence must stop.
That was Monday, and in the name of humanity, it did not stop. There was talk of it stopping today. Secretary of State John Kerry in India, kind of in the middle of the night here, talking about a 72-hour humanitarian ceasefire. He said he'd hoped there would be an opportunity for something more lasting to work out. It hardly lasted at all. Here he was.
It is a lull of opportunity, a moment for the different factions to be able to come together with the State of Israel in an effort to try to address ways to find a sustainable ceasefire.
It barely lasted. Here was the BBC's Martin Patience reporting that ceasefire had ended. People were headed back inside.
4 hours ago, there was relative quiet in Gaza. There was bustling streets. People were going about their daily business. Now people are rushing back home because they've been warned by the Israelis to get indoor because this military operation will resume.
Ann Simmons, the pressure the United States is or is not bringing to bear on Israel. Here, John Kerry's talking, and that's, I guess, where there is some leverage here, though I don't know how much. John Kerry talking about this happening, and then everybody says, well, it didn't last. It barely lasted a couple of hours. Israelis say Palestinian shooting, Palestinians saying the opposite. Is there American leverage here to stop this, or is this out of Washington's hands?
No, it has to be in Washington's hands, and Washington still has to play a role. They have to keep working at it. Obviously, this most recent ceasefire has not lasted. The Israelis have very much spoken about wanting an international external force to police Gaza, but there's obviously no real appetite for that. The U.S. has to keep trying to push for a diplomatic solution. Unfortunately, right now, things seem to be spiraling out of control, and even if Israel does manage to kind of, where they have sent ground forces in, they still have to figure out how do we prevent in future the tunnels from being rebuilt if they do manage to indeed close them down.
John Kerry saying when he was talking about a humanitarian 72-hour ceasefire that did not last, that there would be talks going on during that in Egypt. Now, Egypt previously has played a big role in this. Last week, John Kerry working with Turkey and Qatar to try and work something out. He took a lot of heat for that from the Israeli government and beyond, saying these are not the actors you should be playing with. Here he was on Monday, kind of angry, indignant, defensive, talking about his efforts to reach a ceasefire.
Make no mistake, when the people of Israel are rushing to bomb shelters, when innocent Israeli and Palestinian teenagers are abducted and murdered, when hundreds of innocent civilians have lost their lives, I will and we will make no apologies for our engagement.
Well, all right, Brian, but here was a Secretary of State really back on his heels. If this is the U.S. making a deal, no deal was being made. In fact, the path he'd sort of tiptoed on got him a lot of heat in a hurry.
Well, he is first of all, you can't blame John Kerry for not trying. Mm-hmm. He has been over there hustling between the Egyptians in Qatar and Turkey and the Israelis, trying to put something together. And just, you know, the brief desire for a pause and then make that pause a little bit more durable mm-hmm. and last. It doesn't appear that either side wants that in the long run. The Israelis are very clear that they will not do anything until those tunnels are closed down, either demolished or secured, and until the rockets that are sitting, in some cases, inside neighborhoods, inside schools, inside mosques.
In those tunnels.
In those tunnels are destroyed or otherwise neutralized. And the sad thing is that because Gaza is such a very dense and tight and small area, you know, slightly larger than what, San Francisco, mm-hmm. that
and getting smaller for the population
exactly.
of Israeli soldiers.
There's nowhere to go. Mm-hmm. You know, if you're talking about evacuating from Gaza to or from one neighborhood to another, there's no safe place there. And so as the Israelis are raining down mortars and raining down missiles and the F-16s
and those
in the
terrible
air,
scenes of children, lots of children
there's
dying.
Nowhere to hide there.
Prakash in Des Moines, Iowa. Prakash, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hello, Tom.
Hello. What do you think?
Yep. My comment is pretty simple. No solution is ever brokered by best. Just like between India and Pakistan, Gandhi has to evolve from between Israel and Palestine to broker any peace, or it has to come from within Palestine.
You're saying the West can't do it, a Gandhi has to emerge? That's a pretty tall order. Those don't show up every day, Prakash.
That's right. I guess that's the solution here. Because we've been hearing it since, I mean, I'm only 40 years old. I'm listening mm-hmm. about this war since last 40 years. I'm sure another 40 years it will continue. So it has to come from within. Cannot be brokered.
It's tough to come from within in the situation that we see there. It's hard to say how attitudes change there. It's interesting to look at how attitudes are moving globally. I mean, Ron Mott, we've seen so much social media around this. We've talked about that this week on this show. Sort of new voices coming up, new conversations that aren't constrained or bounded by traditional media, by traditional spokesmen here. Being as I've got you in the studio today, all three of you, I want to ask about this. I mean, we're looking at polls on this, and this is a poll from Gallup that came out late last week saying Americans still substantially see Israel as justified in what it's doing in Gaza. But there's interesting breakdown here. White Americans, 50% say Israel's justified. Americans 65 plus, 55%. But younger Americans, only 18 to 29, only 25% say Israel's justified. And non-white Americans, well, I've got the NABJ here with me, Association of Black Journalists, non-white Americans, only 25% saying justified. What do you make, Ron, of that number, talking with not just African Americans, but Americans of color about what they see in Israel and Gaza?
Well, I mean, I think you have to look at the death toll here. This is an uneven fight. This is not what we would consider a fair fight. We've got 1,460-some-odd Palestinians dead, and that number is sure to rise mm-hmm. if the fighting continues. Mm-hmm. You mentioned 60-some-odd plus Israelis, civilians in there. And I think when the Americans sit back and look at just how uneven that is, and you see pictures on our air, and you see pictures on social media of children and families in just constant states of despair, that's going to change the mood and the tenor. And I think the longer this goes, as much as Americans believe that Israel has a right to defend itself and defend itself vigorously, mm-hmm. when the scale continues to be tipped so heavily at the death toll against the Palestinians, at some point there's a tipping point where the conversation then has to change. And I think we're getting close to that. And I had such hope that we would get a weekend free of mm-hmm. violence over
yes.
there. Went to bed last night mm-hmm. with news of this ceasefire, and it lasted all of 90 minutes, and we're back at it.
Ann Simmons, what do you make of that color gap in polling among Americans on what's going on in Gaza?
It's kind of really kind of looking at kind of having the underdog syndrome. It's kind of supporting the underdog, if you wish, and kind of minorities in this country maybe feeling that kind of we, you know, in some ways have lived a history and know what it's like to be, ostracized, bombarded. But it's an interesting dynamic. It's quite fascinating that there should be more minorities who actually do not believe that Israel has a right to take such action.
Brian, a thought on that front, the color gap in that polling?
Well, and it's, you know, it's not just here but around the world. You saw several actors recently sign a letter, Javier Bardem, his wife Penelope Cruz, supporting the Palestinians in this effort, and came under a lot of flack for that. But, you know, looking at the warfare that's happening, it is, yes, it is very disproportional. The Israelis have the fighter jets. They have the technologies. They have the drones. The Palestinians and Hamas are being funded and armed by Iran, somewhat by Syria. But they're, the military advantage, you know, those, that Iron Dome, that's American.
Protecting Israelis.
Yeah, those are, that's American technology. Those missiles.
I mean, at least it helps keep the death count down somewhere.
It does. But you know, if you just get stuck on the military disproportionality, you miss the big picture. The big picture is that these two groups of people have been at this for a long time, and someone somehow has to at some point say enough.
Kevin in Boston. Kevin, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Hi. I just wanted to make a quick comment. I saw your show the other day with Mona. Talking about social media.
This was Mona Etelhawi out of Egypt, Roger Cohen out of London, and more. Yes, a couple out of Israel.
Yes, yes. I really just want to say that I feel like, you know, and I'm no expert here, but Israel is really working on a 1967 sort of mindset, you know, and times have changed. You know, Israel isn't the underdog anymore. You know, they are the more technologically advanced nation. They look like the bully now. And when you're talking about social media, which is really, you know, garnered towards the younger generation. It's hard for kids to see Israel as the morally superior side, and that's just my comment.
Kevin, we take your point. At the same time, we have seen the video now of Hamas fighters coming up out of those tunnels, heading for Israeli towns and villages and military establishments. We have seen the rockets, and yes, they're protected, but who knows? I mean, that's hard to take, too. Here earlier this week, this was Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu on Israeli television addressing the citizens of Israel, warning of a prolonged war and saying, look, we've got a job to do here. This is interpreted by CNN from the Hebrew.
I said it before and I'll say it again. We must be prepared for a prolonged campaign. We will continue to act with determination and with good judgment until we complete our mission to defend our citizens, to defend our soldiers, to defend our children.
Brian?
Well, you know, and that's interesting, not just what he said, but the use of the media. In this conflict, compared to others, it's been very, very sophisticated when it comes to using social media, Twitter, television. Our own Wolf Blitzer has been there for almost the last month reporting from Tel Aviv. Mm-hmm. And the way that we see, not just on CNN, but on NBC and others, both sides showing up on American television, on American radio, in the press, in print, and online to argue their case. It's you know, I hate to say it this nicely, but it's kind of been impressive how well they've used the media.
Who's they?
Well, both the Israelis and the Palestinians, and even to some degree Hamas. They've been more reluctant to come on the air, but they are getting their message out.
When you say use media, people, my mind goes to propaganda. Are we also getting a clearer sense of the truth or the facts in this, Ron, with more access via social media or not?
I think it muddies the water, the fact that they are engaging in this public relations fight on American airwaves, trying to curry favor with the American public to get support on either
does
side.
Does muddying the water bring us closer to reality? Did we have too black and white a picture before and social media gives us more nuance or less?
I think social media exposes the just how raw this is, and it's getting down, drilling down into the street level. Before a generation or so before social media, it was a much different conversation publicly. Now we're hearing from people on the street. This is how this is affecting us.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. In other news this week, a public apology after a controversial short suspension for Baltimore Ravens player Ray Rice. The whole country saw video of what looked like the aftermath of an assault on his then-fiancée, now wife.
At night, you know, I just replay over and over in my head, you know, that's not me. My actions were inexcusable. And, you know, that's something I have to live with the rest of my life.
talk about that from just hours before the 9/11 attacks. Tape has emerged of former President Bill Clinton telling an audience in Australia that he had missed the chance to kill Osama bin Laden.
I could have killed him, but I would have had to destroy a little town called Kandahar in Afghanistan and kill 300 innocent women and children. And then I would have been no better than him. And so I didn't do it.
Didn't do it because it would have meant killing 300 women and children, so I didn't do it, the former president says. Of course, we're seeing a lot of women and children down this week. In late nights, Jimmy Fallon had fun with talk of impeaching an embattled President Obama.
House Speaker John Boehner said that, in fact, Republicans actually have no plans to impeach the president, which got weird when Obama was like, damn. Almost got out of this thing, yeah.
As in, maybe he'd like to get out of there. We're looking at a week in the news. Gaza, a CIA confession, no deal on the U.S. border, Ebola, Russia-U.S. tensions. We'll look at Ray Rice and more. Ann Simmons is with us from the Los Angeles Times. Brian Monroe of CNN, Ron Mott of NBC. Ann Simmons, there's the president, former president, talking about getting Osama bin Laden. And yes, there were cruise missile attacks back in the day. And I guess what he was saying there, and this is weirdly 10 hours before the 9/11 attacks occurred, he was talking with an audience in Australia. We don't have the tape of this there, but he said, I spent a lot of time as president thinking about Osama bin Laden. He's an intelligent guy, and I'm worried about him. But those attacks didn't happen. Eerie to listen back to that now.
Well, actually, those attacks should not have happened. I think President Clinton,
the cruise missile attack.
I think former President Clinton was absolutely right. When lives are at stake, a whole village of 300 people. We got Osama bin Laden eventually. He was going to be found. But, you know, it should not be at the expense of innocent women and children.
Well, but we got him, but it was years later with 9/11 and everything that ensued out of that, the war in Iraq, war in Afghanistan.
Yeah, we talk about collateral damage, and of course that's to be expected in any war or conflict. But again, I think it on the humanitarian side, the president was absolutely right.
These are hard calculations to do. He said 300 women and children, I couldn't do it. On the other hand, look at the Iraq war. You know this, Brian, the numbers of civilian deaths out of there, estimates at 100,000 plus, you know that includes many women and children.
Yes, and, you know, in fact, many say that was a war that never needed to happen. Because of other decisions. But, you know, kind of going backwards, at some point you have to look at what kind of a country are we? Or, you know, what kind of a people, mm-hmm. whether it's yeah. us or the Israelis or Hamas or the Palestinians or the Russians, you know, what defines us? And I think what defines us is the decisions we make in tough times. Those very difficult calls, whether it's okay to hide missiles in churches and expose civilians to bombings, whether it's okay to bomb a village in Kandahar to get Osama bin Laden. Those define us as a people and I guess our collective soul.
We're going to hear more about how we were tested on that front when this Senate Intelligence Committee report finally comes out on the CIA, that the CIA was so anxious to learn about that it was spying on the Senate. It's all about brutal interrogation. Of course, we're defined by a lot of things this week, fire and drought in the West. David in Madison, Wisconsin. David, you're on the air.
Thank you for taking my call. I think it's rather significant because the drought has reached historic levels. In fact, the drought is the most extreme in recorded history as far as we have it. And I think the significant point is that the governor did all he could within his power, as far as I understand, to recommend and even to somewhat try to mandate in small areas water reduction. And what we've seen in the face of this drought, water levels have increased. So
water levels, you mean usage of water?
Exactly. I'm sorry. Water mm-hmm. usage levels have increased. So I'm not sure where that leaves us for how we're addressing this issue. Economic growth continues. The water use should just continue to go up if growth continues. So I'm not sure how we handle this.
California up against that now. The maps of wildfires in the West, you can see it all over. Ron, I'm sure you've seen some of that. And then this week we had in the midst of this terrible drought, we had these bizarre, sad pictures of water gushing out of that broken water main in Los Angeles, 20 million gallons that they could use otherwise. This was a CBS News interview. UCLA student Ryan Leonard describing the chaos on the campus there after that enormous water main break.
It was just a huge cascade of white water. A friend of mine was walking down and literally had to brace himself with the rail not to get swept out from under himself.
Ron, you've seen the scenes, no doubt. We've all seen the fire, all the coverage of it. We've seen the fields in California just dry as dust. Saw images yesterday of one orange grove owner who was taking out a third of his trees to try and get enough water to the rest of them. This is getting really serious.
Very, very serious. And I really wonder if the folks who live out there appreciate just how grave the situation is with water, especially.
How can they not? There's so much talk about it. The fire. I mean, I was talking with someone in California this week who was in a traffic jam south of San Francisco because there was fire right along the highway. Hard to ignore when the fire's burning next to your car.
But humans are and Americans especially, because we're so used to such conveniences as water running through your pipes at home, we've got to change our mindset about our natural resources and realize that they may not always be there. And especially out west, when you see water being wasted, it really is disturbing to see that. But they've got an issue out on the West Coast that I hope the folks who live out there change their mindset about what they're dealing with.
We're going to spend a full hour on Monday on this latest NASA report that groundwater in the Colorado River area is significantly down, and the entire West looking to have to deal with that. Can we talk about Ray Rice for a minute? We played the tape there at the top, and everybody's, I suppose most people have now seen this video footage where he's, was it Atlantic City where it was taken, and he's stepping out of an elevator, and his now wife, then fiance, kind of falls out or is dragged out behind him. It looks as though there was an assault in that elevator, a kind of domestic violence assault. A 2-game suspension is what came to him, and there was outrage immediately about that, saying this is not enough. Now, you heard that apology, that fresh new apology from Ray Rice at the top of the hour, but we also heard that when he came out on the field at a practice kind of appearance in Baltimore, there was a standing ovation among Baltimore Ravens fans for him. Brian, what do you make of this story?
Well, you know, the outrage is very much appropriate. You know, 2-game suspension for, you know, significant violence against his then fiance, now wife, compared to, you know, their other fines and suspensions for I guess lesser offenses that, you know, smoking marijuana or using drugs or other things that folks get away in pro football get away with, and it just makes sense. It's like where's the line? Where are the values? What's in bounds and out of bounds? And clearly, for those who follow professional football, I guess it's okay to assault a woman.
I don't. And I mean, he was jogging onto the field at M&T Bank Stadium. Crowd of Ravens fans there, giving the running back a standing ovation. Okay, you can't control the fans, but then Baltimore prominently featured news of that standing ovation on its own website, on the Ravens' website, as if to say, hey, our fans still love our guy.
No, it's just outrageous. It really is, Tom. I mean, they could have really used this occasion to send a really strong message that any kind of violence against women is bad. A 2-game suspension? That's nothing. He really should have been punished, I think, to a much greater degree. And as Brian mentioned, I mean, there are severe punishments handed down for far lesser offenses.
Ron, we might have thought that after all the attention that's been around pro sports and pro football, in particular in recent years, that we'd be sort of past this point now. But there we are.
Well, I think, as Ann says, I think the NFL missed, and his commissioner, Roger Goodell, missed a great opportunity here to send a message to society at large in this country. This is the most popular sport in this country. And to have the video of this NFL player dragging his unconscious fiance out of this elevator with such casual air about him was really scary. But I think for folks to keep in mind, this NFL is a violent game. Football is a violent game, and we're asking these young men to be violent on that field. And for some of them, it's difficult to shut that off when they leave the locker room and head home. We had a player in Kansas City kill his girlfriend 2 seasons ago and then kill himself in front of his coaches. A horrific, horrific act. And this was an opportunity for the league to say, we have got to get a hold of this. We cannot have our players out striking women, period, under any circumstances, whether they've been provoked, whether they have been hit themselves. It cannot happen and should not happen, and a 2-game suspension doesn't suggest that the league takes that seriously.
You know, and kind of stepping back, we've hit a couple topics today, the Ray Rice situation, the drought in California, congressional dysfunctions. And the one thing that those three things have in common is, for good or for bad, it's us. It's the American people You saw the crowds that came out to support Ray Rice, cheering despite what he did. You saw
a whole lot of others saying, wait a minute.
Yeah, that's true. But in California, the underlying thing behind the drought is that there's expansion and growth in population in the Southwest. More people are coming into this country and growing and living in an area where there's fewer resources. In Congress, we elect and reelect dysfunctional members of Congress. It's on us.
John in Dover, Delaware. John, you're on the air. Thank you for calling.
Hi, Tom. How are you?
Okay. What do you think, John?
Well, about Ray Rice.
Yep.
He's been in the league now about 6 years. He has done a number of things in Baltimore that probably your panel and a lot of your listeners don't know about in terms of anti-bullying and helping kids and all of those.
You're saying good things, okay?
Oh yeah, a lot of really good things. Mm-hmm. Now, I don't condone beating on women or any of that. Don't misunderstand me, but. We don't know what went on in that elevator. That's never been made public. We don't know whether she had anything to do with it or whether there was a lot of drinking. That much we know. Past that, we don't know everything. And to make an example out of somebody like Ray, who has done so many good things for people and in the league's name for the last 6 years when he's made this mistake, I think is unfair.
Hey, John, yeah. You know, I take your point, maybe, but you've got Ray himself now saying it was the worst mistake of his life. That doesn't sound like, she just tripped over her shoestrings in there. Life is complicated, but that complicated?
No, oh, my goodness. I respect the caller's opinion, but no, this is just an unconscionable act. He certainly should have been punished. And to view the woman being dragged out of the elevator, out of the lift, was just awful. And it doesn't matter what she said or did. She did not deserve that.
Talk about awful. The Ebola outbreak in West Africa, we talked about it on this show weeks ago when it was just beginning to gear up. It has really soared now. More than 700 dead. The biggest outbreak ever. And now we've seen Americans who were there, the lead doctors working on this in big trouble, lead doctors from Guinea, from Sierra Leone. It's in Nigeria now. Paying a price there. I think the top doctor, one of those countries dying from this. This was the president of Sierra Leone yesterday declaring a state of emergency over Ebola.
I hereby proclaim a state of public emergency to enable us to take a more robust approach to deal with the Ebola outbreak.
Now we've got one American being flown home. She's in dire straits here for her case to be dealt with in an Atlanta hospital, at Emory, I think it is, Ron. But talk about a globalized world. Ebola, remember just a few years ago, it was something far away in the middle of a huge continent. And now we've got this outbreak in urban centers and talk of it traveling.
Right. And you've got health officials here and around the world putting everyone on guard. And that's a good thing. And I think I would caution people to be careful about believing wholeheartedly in calls that this virus is not going to take root. It's not a threat to the United States. You've got a patient on the way here. And I think that in and of itself will give people some pause that you're bringing a patient with this virus.
But they're going to put her in isolation.
Isolation. But I think because we live in such a small world, you can get, in 12 hours, you can be on the other side of the planet. And this is a disease that is not communicated through air. You have to have some close contact.
Fluids.
But this is a very dangerous virus.
Well, yes. But I mean, I've seen so many public health officials say where you've got a decent health system, you can smother this disease. And this is Peter Piot. He was co-discoverer. He's director of the London School of Hygiene, telling AFP, spreading in the population here, that's the UK, he said, I'm not that worried about it. He said, I wouldn't be worried to sit next to someone with Ebola virus on the tube as long as they didn't vomit on you or something. Oh great.
Yeah, it's understanding kind of the difference between a infectious disease and a contagious disease.
Yeah.
The flu is very contagious. It can spread airborne. You can touch, the handrail or the doorknob and pick up the flu virus. Ebola, as deadly as it is very infectious because of fluid transfer. But if you see the doctors,
the isolation
in the suits
around
and
it,
and all that,
we can tamp it down.
And the way to manage, the body can fight that disease if it's properly hydrated in their fluids. And that's what they're doing. They're for the patients that have it, they're trying to get more fluids in them so that the body can take over and try to do what it can do.
The U.S. economy talking getting more fluids in so the body can take over. The 209,000 jobs added last month when the expectation was of a lot of jobs. Weirdly, the Dow just swooned. Why? Because they thought the Fed would start ratcheting up interest rates. And so we've got this economy up, Dow down. But not up as much as they thought unemployment run.
Right. Well, I mean, I think, you know, what happened yesterday was obviously not very good. And Argentina may have something
on the stock market,
something to do with that. Mm-hmm. But I saw, you know, a report here last night about the second quarter growth, you know, at 4%, I believe, or so. Mm-hmm. But it does not feel like a 4% economy right now.
Financial Times headline, I've got it right here, says U.S. economy comes roaring back. And the next day, the Dow down 300 points. We've still got some rough seas here.
Yeah, I mean, we have to ride it out. And I mean, if you're watching your retirement dollars and you're close to retirement, this is probably not a very pleasant time for you.
And at the White House this week, Linda Ronstadt awarded the National Medal of Arts at the White House. President admitting, said, I had a little crush on her back in the day. We'll go out with her first number one country hit way back. She's got Parkinson's now. God bless her. But she was sure great. When will I be loved? Ron Mott with NBC News. So great to have you with us today.
Great
thank
to be
you
with
for
you,
coming
you
in. Ann Simmons with the Los Angeles Times. Wonderful to have you with
thank
us.
Thank you so much.
And Brian Monroe of CNN. Thanks as always, Brian.
Thanks for having us here in Boston.
Listeners, thank you for joining us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.